New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is a program of empowerment. Today, we're going to give you the latest on health and healing and how you can live a longer, more vital life. We only use mainstream consensus-based good science. You hear all the citations, the universities, the peer-reviewed journals, and most importantly, how mainstream science actually is the guiding light for so many of the healthy lifestyle choices. What does it mean in lay language? It means that if we follow the advice that is being proven by good scientists all over the world, there's no reason that we couldn't live an additional 30 years in absolute good health. But we have to look at how sick most people are at this moment, more often than not, because of the environment they live in and the circumstances of their choices. Can we repair that damage? You bet. Can we reverse aging even if we're 80, 90? Absolutely. There's no reason that we cannot make 70 the new 35. Seems impossible? It is not. We're doing it. And that's what we do each day. Also today, I'm going to be using some new insights that I developed for an upcoming lecture. I'll give you kind of a preview of it. And it falls right in line with Sandy Grant, is a philosopher who teaches University of Cambridge, an article called Enjoy. Also today, I want to take you inside the mind of many, not all, millennials and why they're fed up with capitalism, in their own words, in 3 minutes and 49 seconds. Also, fluoride is poison. Now, I'm updating as we speak the fluoride article. It'll be done within a week. But in the interim, Abby Martin is going to share what she discovered about fluoride and how toxic it is in a 5-minute piece. And then I'm starting a new series. Each week for the next 10 weeks, I'll be presenting a program on poor in America, but actually taking you to those locations where I personally go. And today I'm in a camp in New Jersey. It's about 2 hours from New York City. I drove down there with my camera crew, and here was a camp of about 100 people, more or less. And you'll see, and by the way, when you watch this later in the day on Facebook, you'll see the video. And you'll see how people who formerly were professors at a university, an art director of an advertising agency, people with really interesting backgrounds who are now living as if they have no assets at all, just a little camper or whatever they have put together. But how the federal government, the state government, and local communities don't want them there. And this is not just here, it's everywhere I go. So you'll also see in an upcoming program, people living, the whole hour is devoted to people living out of their cars. Another hour I filmed, people living out of vans. Another hour, people living out of RVs. And they have no resources except at some point they put whatever money they had into at least a place where they wouldn't be homeless. But do you have any idea what it's like when you wake up in the morning and you have to get propane where you can't cook, where you have to get clean water and you can't store a lot of it, enough for maybe 3 or 4 flushes of a toilet and a short shower, and you're not wanted any place, and if you park on the streets, depending upon the state, you'll get a fine. So anyhow, that is all what we're going to be talking about today. So we have a lot to share, and we always try to give you insights that can empower you. We're going to start with the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine study. It talks about why social isolation can bring a greater risk of illness. And we all know, or should, that social isolation has been linked to a wide range of health problems, as well as a shorter lifespan, We're talking about, there is no absolute number on this, but the best I can do with a mathematical model I created based upon social interventions, which is why, for example, in all my lectures, in my writings and on this radio program, I share that health is not one single piece of a puzzle, but many. And each one has a value if it's good to add to your life, if it's bad to take away. But if you have lived 5 years in social isolation, meaning you just don't have a network of friends, you don't go out and socialize a lot, you're more often than not just alone, you can decrease your lifespan by about 3 years. And not only that, but you end up with heart disease and cancer and diabetes. In fact, during a U.S. Senate hearing on aging, just this past spring, a representative from the Gerontological Society of America urged lawmakers to support programs to help adults stay connected to their communities, stating that social isolation, quote, is a silent killer that places people at higher risk for a variety of poor health outcomes. Now, researchers at the Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania, have found a possible explanation for this association. The team observed that in this experiment, that social isolation leads to sleep loss, which in turn leads to cellular stress and the activation of a defense mechanism called the unfolded protein response, or UPR. And their findings are published in the journal Sleep, and they found that in virtually all animal species, this happens, and in humans as well, we need sleep. We need quality sleep. And they found with diabetes, with heart disease, with cancers, with depression and anxiety disorders, people do not get quality sleep. And that impacts a stress chemical reaction in the body. So here's a solution. Why don't some of the people in this audience start an online social networking where the purpose is for people to at least connect with other people who share similar ideas about life and health, and then have discussions. Not just chit-chatting, but actual discussions where each week someone brings a theme that would help everyone, and you can discuss it. And during the week, you can research, do your homework, become proactive in a positive way. And that way, you're sharing this, everyone's sharing, and you develop friendships. And then, at least if geologically or geographically you're close, get together for meetings. Go out and do something, like go to a movie together. Then spend time afterwards discussing it. That simple process on a regular basis allows you to reconnect and look forward to things. For example, last night I just stopped my work for a little while and I went out to see a movie. It was about The Thread. It's Daniel Day-Lewis's supposedly last film. And the story is about a high-end but very traditional fashion designer in London in the 1950s. And he has this beautiful townhouse, and people come on a regular basis, and he has a team of about 20 people sewing, and he's sewing. He's quiet. He is very urbane. He is very intellectual. But then someone comes into his life, a younger person, like an ingenue, and the relationship then takes the rest of the film. But you have a chance to see fairly accurate of what it is to be a creative assertive. You see, the filmmaker didn't know that how you respond to people is frequently based upon your life energies, and creative people, that could be playwrights and artists and sculptors and theater people, they need time alone. They become frequently annoyed if people in their lives constantly need attention because so much of their life is spent attending to their creativity. In fact, it's like a pendulum. And I figured this out. In fact, I wrote a whole book on this. It's out of print now, but it was called Who Are You Really? Because I saw that creative people didn't fit into society neatly. For example, if you had 12 people show up at a formal dinner, all in tuxedos and gowns. And suddenly at the end of the table, someone comes in dressed as a clown. They're all in surprise. But if someone says, oh, they're an artist. Oh, okay. We understand that. So we understand that artists think differently, act differently, see the world differently. And thank goodness they do, because they're the ones who are the first with any social cause to do the posters, to define the opposition in a way that frequently characterizes them and mocks their absurdities. And they're fearless. I found them to be extraordinarily courageous. And in fact, I'll give you an idea of how this works. We had 24 hours notice that they were going to make the flu vaccine mandatory for all health professionals in New York State. You'd have to get four vaccines, all containing mercury, or 100 milligrams of mercury. That's more than 100,000% more than what the body should ever have, or would even be allowed by the EPA. In any case, it was a done deal. And someone in the audience sent me the information. I broadcast it on the program. We only had 24 hours. So I put the word out, and I said, let's all meet. We'll rent some buses, we'll call carpool, and we'll go up to Albany tomorrow morning. We'll protest on the steps. And 1,400 listeners showed up. An artist had worked overnight, and they had these really interesting and unique posters. And so in front of the Capitol, there was 100 posters, and people were holding the posters. Well, Fox showed up, and Bloomberg showed up, and ABC showed up. And suddenly, we put up a podium. I flew Dr. Eisenstein from Chicago in. We brought a guy from another doctor from Washington, D.C. up that night. All this within 24 hours. In any case, and then I sent people dressed in suits and business suits looking like they belonged to the legislature. But they all had 110 pages of scientific literature on why the vaccine ingredients were toxic and it had never been tested in humans to determine its safety. Hence, we were going to make every nurse, orderly, physician, anyone working in any healthcare facility in New York a human guinea pig and loading them up with mercury. And we had the best science in these 110 pages. We put it on a disc. So they got right through security. Not one was stopped because they looked like they belonged there. And they went to every single legislator in New York State and gave them a copy of this report and said that we were doing a demonstration outside. Well, suddenly all these other people came around, and now they were forced to invite us in. So I was invited in, and Dr. Michael Schachter was invited in, and one lawyer came with us, was invited in, one of my team lawyers. And we sat with the top medical doctors in New York State and explained why what they were doing was wrong. And this was clearly ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, a group, in my personal opinion, it's a criminal organization. And every single legislator who has met in secret with them and been handed bills should be forced to resign because these people have sold out the voters in every state. Well, they've been around for 25 to 30 years. They've passed, we know of, at least 23,000 pieces of legislation, laws, only to benefit these major 200 to 300 corporations and not the citizens. In any case, so we made our argument. Because of that, they had to put a moratorium. Then they had to hold public hearings. In fact, what I'll do, if I have time today, I'm going to ask my engineer in New York to look up it should be on your playlist, because I went over it yesterday with Jesse, my testimony, 3-part testimony, before the New York State Health Commission, and I was supposed to be the first in the morning to testify because I was there at 8 o'clock. No one was there, and you testify based upon how you sign in. I was the first person to sign in. I was the last person selected. They intentionally kept me from being the first because the mainstream media was there. They didn't want to hear what I had to say. So all their pro-vaccine advocates were all lined up. So dead last, no one was there. Everybody had gone. They gave me a chance to talk. Well, as you will see, I do not offer deference to authority or power. I get in its face. Fortunately, someone, I don't know who, filmed it. I was not aware of it, and they sent us the film. So what you will hear and what you can see later on my Facebook, because we post this on Facebook, so you can actually see the video or the audio clip, is the arguments. And because of that, we were able to forestall mandatory vaccines. So don't believe that being citizen journalist doesn't matter. It does. Don't believe that being an artist and involving yourself to do something that brings a cause to the public's attention the way they can understand, it does. So creative people make an enormous difference. You just have to understand them. So if you got together with other people and you were to go out and socialize and you were to go see something, not one of the stupid films, but meaningful films, some of the art films, some of the documentaries, and then have discussions, now you're elevating the relationship to one of social values and human interest. Just something to think about. It's one way we can overcome social isolation. It's one way we can get people out of their homes and apartments and get them engaged in issues again and get that heart pulse beating again. From Ohio State University and the American Heart Association, they have a new study. I found this important because it shows that breast cancer treatments, there's your radiation and chemotherapy, can increase the risk of heart disease. Now, breast cancer patients may be at a really increased risk of cardiovascular disease, including heart failure, because the treatment they got for their cancer. And this was published in the journal Circulation, which is the top journal read by cardiologists and heart specialists. So I think it's very important that you understand that many of the treatments given for cancer, no matter how they're projected, are purely experimental. Only about 11% of the therapies that I have been able to research, and I've done a lot of research on this, are effective. That means that almost 90% are not. And you'll see the ads on television, the little girl and the little boy, they pull your heartstrings, and where you see kids who have cancer, and you know they're shown being, you know, very vulnerable. And all of us are touched deeply and should be when we see a child suffering. And of course, then you pick up the phone and you say, yeah, I want to donate. What you're not seeing is how many of those children end up getting chemotherapy or radiation or both and then die because of the therapy. Over 500,000 Americans will die this year from cancer. And you never see that side of the equation discussed. You never hear about how oncologists can actually buy the drugs at wholesale. Let's say they buy a month's supply for a patient at $15,000, it costs them $7,000, they make the spread, $8,000. So let's say you're treating 100 patients and you're making $8,000 per month, per patient. Wow, millions of dollars a year, and it's completely legal. Or what if you're a rheumatologist and you're given $200 per patient if they use a drug from a specific manufacturer? What about all the other ways of reversing and improving arthritis without drugs? You'll never hear about it. So we have to get the profit out of medicine. And we've got to let people know that the treatments for breast cancer could end up causing a heart attack or a stroke or heart failure. There's no reason at this time, with all the good science we have on natural approaches to breast cancer, to not be treating people with natural approaches. And then, of course, we also have to look at a study at McGill University, and they're showing that calcium from a lot of people's diets is ending up in the arteries, and partly it's because of the form the calcium is taking. And they did some good research on this. And my suggestion is that the best way of getting calcium is by taking in sea vegetables, wakame, arami, ajiki, kombu, and dulse, but also, and sea lettuce, but also kale, collard greens, arugula, chicory. Those are all good. Sesame seeds, all good sources, and tahini of calcium. When calcium goes into your body from natural sources, it is not bound to any chemical, and it ends up in your bones where it belongs, with a small amount circulating in the body, because you need calcium to keep your muscles from cramping. But it should be with magnesium also. And frequently, those same foods I just mentioned also give you a nice serving of magnesium. From Louisiana State University, they're looking at red wine proving good for your heart. Why? It's the antioxidants. There are enough antioxidants, which is not a lot, in a glass of red wine, and it helps prevent heart disease. And heart disease occurs when plaque builds up within your artery walls. There's your hot dogs, your pretzels, your potato chips, your pizzas, your buns, your bread, the red meat. That's where the plaque builds up. That's the source of it. And then that blocks the flow of blood through the tissues in the body, and that increased the risk of a heart attack or stroke. This year, about 630,000 people will die in the United States from a heart disease. And we could reduce that tremendously if we changed to a plant-based healthy diet, plus took magnesium and coenzyme Q10 and L-carnitine and cayenne and mixed vitamin E and hawthorn. Just those alone, we would cut, I believe, heart disease by at least 50%. And those are also able to help the body chelate some of the, especially with green juices, chelate out the plaque. And also they're finding, the University of Rochester Medical Center found and published in Scientific Reports that that red wine is also good for your brain. That's great. It's good for the brain. Why? Once again, because it can turn off inflammation in the brain, and it impacts in a positive way the central nervous system. Both of those are important to know. And finally, I was asked recently about natural aphrodisiacs. Okay. We do know, and there's strong scientific evidence from the peer-reviewed literature, that there are foods that are backed by strong scientific evidence that can help you with libido and function. Write them down. I'm going to give them to you real quick. Chocolate. That's correct. Compounds in cacao are aphrodisiac, and also in women. And then oysters, chasteberry, chasteberry, and that's a fruit. And I've used it to help people, women, reduce premenopausal syndrome, and I would suggest the hot chilies are important. Some of the things that can make a difference that are easy to obtain. Now, there are a lot of herbs, but I won't get into that today. On another show, I will. And I mentioned the other day about eating insects. Here's the latest on that. It is not new in Africa, South America, and Asia to be eating insects. In fact, the insects are high in protein. They're right up there with meat or soybeans in quality of protein. And it's aesthetically not pleasing to think about eating insects, but if you're wanting to get away from eating beef and chicken and fish, and you want to have some source of insect protein, now there are powders coming out on the market where they've done it for you, where they've gotten the insects, they sterilize them, and then they pulverize them and put them into a powder and then add some flavoring. And then when you read the ingredients, they're very high in amino acid compounds and very low in calories. And we don't have to feed the insects. Most of these are wild-caught insects. So insects, for the vegans, they don't have to worry about it. But for other people, it's been a source of nutrition for a long time. And also, this is from an interesting study I just read. is from the Indian Institute of Science, and they discovered in their experiment that mice administered a drug, one of the most popular drugs for HIV infection, had, quote, a significant reduction in mature B lymphocytes in 70% of my study. What this means is, what if the very drugs used to treat HIV infection are contributing to the development of AIDS? That's the question they're asking here. So the so-called antiretroviral HIV drugs in the integrase inhibitor category have been long touted as life-saving interventions, and yet concerning new research indicates that they may not be living up to their promises. And because the purported effect of HIV infection is disruption of the immune system, any treatment that is immunotoxic or immunodisruptive has the potential to worsen the condition and contribute to the diagnosis and progression of AIDS. Now, if you're in the world of AIDS, you're not allowed to criticize any of the treatments, no matter how deadly and toxic, as a lot of the journalists, activists, and physicians and others have found. But at some point, and I believe people have the right to choose the therapy that they desire. So if you want the drugs, fine, you should take them. But if you want to look for another way of helping your immune system, then there are many ways you can also help build the immune system. And I posted numerous articles, including a major chapter in a textbook I wrote with over 3,000 scientific references to back it up. In fact, there's 95 pages of scientific references, so it's the accuracy of the material is not in question, but it does not match the politics of those who profit off the drugs and those who they pay to be their spokespersons and the guard dogs of the orthodox approach. So, just something to think about. There are several ways to approach HIV infection and AIDS, and we should have democracy in science and healing. And if we don't, then we're limiting ourselves. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll on location. And by the way, the final day to watch the film, the newest documentary, hard-hitting documentary, on the dangers of vaccines, but also on the corruption within the field, especially the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Services. The film is called Deadly Deception. It's there as a public service. You can go to prn.fm and watch it. And I read an article yesterday, an original, in-depth, fully referenced scientific article on the CDC vaccines in the deep state. It's also there for you to read and reference and share. The key is sharing. Also, before I go to a commentary, I want to mention that I was thinking about how everyone brags about Google and all these other big search engines and how many tens of thousands of people work for them, but we have no say-so over what they do and how they cooperate with the CIA and other intelligence agencies in sharing data about us. Everything we've ever posted, it's there. So what I'm doing now is I'm starting a movement, and it's just in its infancy, but very, very, very important. We're taking about 100 issues right now. I'll give you an example. One of the issues is, which medical procedures in hospitals are unnecessary and but are there because they're profitable to the hospital? So someone's going to take that, a citizen journalist, do the homework on it using only qualified references so the information is credible and will stand challenge. Then just work up the synopsis, then we will present that. And if a person's articulate, I'm going to invite them on the air to make their presentations. But if they're, you know, don't want to come on the air, that's fine. We will make it on their behalf and note if they want credit, we'll certainly note them. We're doing one right now on the latest research on the dangers of genetically modified organisms. And so that'll take about a week or two to get all the research. So we're going over 100 major issues, showing you the truth that we are denied access to by the mainstream and even alternative media. Our standards are high. Our scholarship is never been challenged because we vet everything. We have a team of lawyers and scholars who vet everything for accuracy. So agent provocateurs can't plant misinformation, which they otherwise have tried but didn't succeed or would. So we're going to have an ongoing insights and information on hundreds of issues that right now you wouldn't know where to start. But we help you get started, and you can do it from your home. And we've had medical doctors, professors of universities, psychologists, judges, lawyers, school teachers, retired, all kinds of people saying, yeah, I'll help. Good. It's for a common cause. So we can challenge the Googles and the Facebooks and the AMA. We can challenge, you know, the Coleman Foundation by wearing a pink ribbon. Suddenly that's supposed to mean that we're all fighting breast cancer in the right way. All this nonsense. We're going after all these issues, hundreds of issues. And the people I see do the best work and turn it in and it's ready to go, then they'll be given some far more adventurous and insights that I cannot discuss on the air, but will be good for the public to know the truth on. So you can, if you want to be a citizen journalist, and again, you can do it from your home, your in your own time, go to PRN, that's Progressive Radio Network, prnstudio@gmail.com. And just give us a little bio on yourself and your background, and you'll be contacted. Also, I'm putting together, actually it's done, but my time is so tight right now doing the investigative report that I'm doing that will be released in the spring, and hopefully some major lawsuits with it. I intend to bring some, well, we have a whole team of attorneys. And I can't say more than I'm going to go after some people and some organizations big time. And they will not be able to squeeze out of this. They don't know it's coming. It will. And you'll hear about it because I'm going to break it all on the program in the late spring. But at some point in the late spring, after I do that, my goal is to have a center, an actual physical place, where people would like to spend some time, maybe a couple weeks, months, doing work on important investigative reports and documentaries, what I call short documentaries, ones that are maybe 20 minutes long, 15 minutes long, half hour long, where they can live in a place, do their work, have encrypted equipment so nobody can know what they're doing, hack into it, and then we can get that up on the internet. It's all for the internet. It's not for theaters, television, not selling anything. It's all going to be free. So the first part of that is done. We're ready. But I have to be there when I do this and select the people who are going to be there. But it's coming. It'll be there in about 2 months. So I thank you all for joining to be citizen journalists and speaking your truth to power. Yesterday I counseled a person who has had a really rough life and is lucky to be alive. I won't say more than that. And I believe that that person today has a real chance of regaining their health and gaining their life back because of some simple insights. I'd like to share those and see if it resonates with you. I'm also going to be sharing insights from Sandy Grant from EON. How many of you, like myself, have been engaged in something, a relationship, a project, going someplace, maybe traveling, a sporting activity, like a marathon, and you're in it, you're really excited by it, your whole body is happier, you feel good, you're with other people, you're challenging yourself, you're learning something new, you're stretching yourself. And then it's over. Maybe we waited a month to go to a concert, or maybe a year to train for a marathon, or maybe 2 or 3 years to take a trip to a special place, maybe to India or some other place, to learn about a culture. And then there's that kind of letdown. Like, wow, you're on your way back from the trip, and you're still thinking of all the wonderful sights and sounds and smells and tastes, the cuisines and the people, and it's fresh in your memory. But a week later, you're back to the drudgery of the ritual of life. Visualize that for a moment. Have any of you who have a pet ever, when you're with a pet and you're just loving that moment, part of your mind thinks, well, one day this pet's going to die, or maybe I'll die before the pet. And part of you begins to go through a mourning process while you're still in the moment with that pet or person. How often have we been with someone we really adored, someone we love being with, because there was just that energy, that smoothness. They lived like Fred Astaire danced, smooth. And we thought, wow, how lucky am I to always see a person that is harmonizing with me. But then one day, for whatever reason, it's over. And now there's that emptiness, and there's that disconnect. You're no longer having your music of life heard by someone who would appreciate it. So at all times, we're living with this sense of expiration, that everything has an expiration date, and yet we're conditioned to believe that everything should be permanent. Permanent friends, permanent resident, permanent job. That's how I grew up, and I'm sure many of you as well. Everywhere, imperceptibly or otherwise, things are passing. They're ending. They're going. And there will be other summers to enjoy, other band concerts, but never this one. That's the key. Never again. Never as now. So next year, when I look in the mirror, I'm not going to see the same person I see now. I may see myself older or younger. One of the reasons that I occasionally post some photographs, like I just did a race. I did a state championship race 2 weeks ago Sunday, and I did well, and I took a gold medal. And I was happy with my, more than anything, my form. I was working on it. And now throughout the next 6 months, I'm going to do more races. But I just put a shot up there right after the race. And the reason I did was to motivate other people to realize that no matter what your age, you don't have to live by the rules that you can't do something because you're older. In point of fact, frequently the things we did not fully appreciate when we were engaged when we were younger, we now have the patience to savor moments, to slow it down, to appreciate a meal, a person, whatever it is we're doing, we're more present. That is the advantage of wisdom. That is the advantage of learning to appreciate everything in life and taking nothing for granted. Do you think I ever take kindness for granted? No. And it's the small gestures in life that really impress me. I remember once I went out on a date with a woman, and at the end of it, she says, "Let me pay." And I said, "Let us share." And she said, "Okay." Now, what impressed me was this was a person making about $20,000 a year. And it wasn't an expensive meal. You know, when you're vegan, you're a cheap date, right? And it might have been $30, but $30 is a lot of money. But what impressed me was that she thought enough of that meeting to want to pay her share. And yet I've had people who've been extremely wealthy who didn't think about paying for anything. They expected everything to be done for them. Well, that would be the last time I'd see someone who was selfish. Small gestures stick with you. How people touch your heart sticks with you. Kindness, joy, laughter, laughing at yourself, self-deprecating humor is some of the funniest humor. It sticks with you. The person that gets upset about everything is offended by everyone. You don't want that to stick to you. So we are a nation that has been conditioned not to appreciate that which is finite. We become fatalistic only later because we never slow down long enough to appreciate the moment we're in unless we do. And then we become almost concerned that it's too transient, too ephemeral. We laugh while clutching, holding tenderly, almost like a fool with a toy. Water through our fingers is how most people live their life. How many times have I counseled people, one in particular, one has been a friend for a long time, and just over the last 10 years I've had to save his life on 3 separate occasions. I mean, literally, if I didn't intervene, he would have died. And he works at a hospital, he's an administrator, because his lifestyle is so toxic, both physically and emotionally. But you can't transgress boundaries. You have to respect that whatever choice a person makes, even if it's a bad choice, they're getting something from it. And that's what confuses us. What in the world could you possibly get from a bad relationship, from being around toxic people, controlling people, sarcastic people, negative people? What do you gain from that? The trouble is people do. What do you gain by wanting to be rescued or trying to rescue people? There's a gain, but it's never a good one. And then you ask the person, if you had a choice, and I actually invited the person, because he's a friend, to come down to my home for a month, because he's done it in the past, and I got him to lose 100 pounds, and I got him all 15 to 17 medications, and we had an end-stage congestive heart failure, got his heart back to health, his blood pressure, his 500 blood sugar down to 100, and yet goes back home and goes right back to the old ways. So what's he gained by that? That's a person living in fear. They know that today they can't live over, but they don't use that day constructively to appreciate it. It's like a good meal. I eat in silence. And when I do a retreat, it's always in silence. Why? I want people to appreciate just looking at the food, smelling the food, the mouthfeel of the food, the aftertaste, because they're going to become what they're eating, and they're getting the best I can give them, so now I want them to appreciate it. But how often do we stop long enough to appreciate, really savor the moment? It's going to be gone in 5 minutes, that moment's gone, an hour, that meal's done. Well, what did you do to enrapture yourself in that moment? Did you listen to someone or did you talk over them? Did you hear what they had to say or did you just think that dismiss it as irrelevant because you had something more relevant to say? Do you need to control the outcome of everything? Because that determines your perception of the moment that you're in. Wasn't the American poet Sylvia Plath ask whether there is something inescapably painful about enjoyment? Maybe enjoyment makes you anguished and miserable. Perhaps this is what we don't always understand. We're almost afraid to be too happy. We're afraid to be too healthy. We're afraid to be too free. We're afraid to be too creative. We're afraid to slow down and stop all the excessive gesturing, the hyperkinetic extremes to which our energy will be unbound because the void of that moment, the silence of that moment, the stillness of that moment, but the completeness of that moment allows us to appreciate the place we have in the world in that moment. And that we're terrified of. And to understand why it is so, we need to clarify what we're debating. Philosophers have puzzled over the question of what enjoyment is, proposing competent accounts of pleasure, but we can take a straightforward view that enjoyment is a distinctive state of finding an experience pleasurable. The hallmark feature of pleasure, in turn, is a feel-good quality. An enjoyable experience feels good. I remember how many times I would go running with friends, and boy, does it feel good when you're striding like gazelles and you're running through the park stride for stride, breath for breath, shoulder to shoulder. Wow, what an experience. That feels good. Well, that's joy. And it can be distinguished thus from painful ones, which feels bad. Does then the transitory nature of enjoyment undermine its worth? Or might that very brevity of enjoyment be part of its importance to life? Even those philosophers who have advocated for pleasure as a good have struggled with the issue of its brevity. Aristippus, a pupil of Socrates, is remembered as the founder of a school of philosophy which was centered on hedonism, or the belief that pleasure is the good. In his view, we should live for the pleasures of the moment. And Aristippus insisted that the brevity of pleasure does not detract from their worth, and his followers in the school continue to explore the significance of the present moment of pleasure over future experiences. Indeed, immediate and bodily pleasures were most valuable rather than any sort of elaborate accounting of which pleasures are better or longer lasting than others, which would form part of an account of long-term happiness such as Aristotle proposed. And Aristippus is reported to have said, the art of life means enjoying pleasures as they pass. However, for him, that very brevity warranted an ideal of self-control, a contentment with what present pleasures there are. So the good life rests upon the exercise of self-constraint. You avoid desiring, and you attempt a sort of self-sufficiency. You don't let yourself get attached to any particular pleasure, since moments of ever-passing and pleasure are all changeable, and such brevity requires a regulatory self-control. And Aristippus is supposed to have counseled what is best is not abstaining from pleasures, but instead controlling them without being controlled. So what does this mean? It means that we are all aging. We are all experiencing the same capacity for time, but we're not all experiencing that time the same. Some people become so committed to their dramas, so committed to their crisis, so committed to their responsibility, so committed to their ritual, so committed to following consensus. Every day, they're going to eat the same, wash the same, watch the same television programs, go to the commuter the same amount of time. They forget that that moment is no longer a moment of pleasure. It is a moment of control. The environment is controlling you. Your ritual controls you. Your attitude controls you. Your beliefs control you. Your epigenetic conditioning controls you. So where is the person able to be free from fear and judgment and denial of their right to experience a moment? If I want to experience a beautiful meal without talking, that's my right. I don't want to have to feel that I have to talk with everyone else or somehow I'm ostracized. I want to be able to get up and go out and work my body. Yes, it's going to take time and commitment, but I'm going to be able to feel good about how healthy I am, rather than feeling some sense of fatalistic remorse and contempt for the health. Think of how many people are in contempt of health, who mock happiness, who deride spirituality, who are utterly loath to accept that your health, your happiness Yes, it's as fleeting as every other moment there is in life, and every breath we take is fleeting because the next takes its place. But what if we don't allow the circumstances of our life to control our perception of our life? What if we are free and unbounded from these constraints? What if we can be a free human being in the moment we're in and look at the things that give us pleasure, but also give pleasure to others, to the animals, to the people, to society, to the forest? We will not adulterate it. We will not abuse it. Because when you're living in that kind of spiritual awareness of the moment, you respect and honor life versus the people who live in contempt of that very philosophy. And those represent another classical hedonist who became known as the death persuader. He took the momentary character pleasure to render the quest for true lasting pleasure fruitless and advocated for the avoidance of pain instead. And he is the one that most people are guided by today. So if you want to avoid pain, take no risks. If you want to avoid rejection, do not venture into any relationship, any project, any creative endeavor. If you want to avoid poison ivy, do not go to nature. If you want to avoid being eaten by a shark, stay out of the water. If you want to avoid frostbite, don't venture above a certain degree in temperature and latitude. If you want to avoid the body politic, don't vote. If you want to avoid all the different commitments we should have to a society, don't become engaged in anything. And therefore, your pleasure comes only in a diabolical nature of what you have avoided. So with the 80 no's that were all given to one yes as children, you're living with 1,000 no's. You resist everything. Do you want it? No. How about no? Can't you take some time off? No. Let's go get help. No. Don't you desert? No. Now think of how living by a defense of not wanting to engage in pain, we end up not knowing true pleasure. And then we see everything nihilistically. And that's unfortunate. I'm Gary Nall. I'm going to use the last several minutes of our program for talkback. If you'd like to share your thoughts, call us at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And until the phones come in, I just want to mention that I have posted the lecture, the testimony I gave under oath before the state to keep mandatory vaccines from happening. And guess who didn't show up? Guess who didn't show up at all? Nurses and physicians and orderlies, the very people that we, the people, the artists, the activists, the social activists, we were there to be your voice because you did not have the time. It was not a priority. It wasn't important to you. You probably might not have cared whether or not you got 4 vaccines with mercury. Isn't it amazing that the activists care more for the life and the health of people than those who should show up? And guess who never shows up? Doctors, judges, the people who are at the high end of society never show up. And yet we, the people, on their behalf, fight their battle. Now there is something that is important. So if some calls come in, I'll be happy to take them, but otherwise I'll finish off my thought. So what does this mean? It means for the person I counseled yesterday that they no longer have to live with the idea of suicide. They no longer have to feel that they do not deserve life. They no longer have to feel that they can live in clutter and be a part of the system of human refuge where they feel they have no value to society, and they're incompatible with life. To the contrary, everyone is compatible with life, and everyone has a reason to be alive. You just have to determine that's where your energy is going to go. So if you put life in all of its important responsibilities, in its commitment to a higher ideal and helping others as the centerpiece of your life, then that brings joy, because purpose that is positive is always something that motivates us to be more disciplined in the choices we make. If I want to help others, shouldn't I be a healthier person so I can live longer to help others? And the answer is yes. Just something to think about. And that person said now they got it, and now they're going to be living a different type of life. and look for quality information from different sources. Because what you are now, you're going to be the mindset for a public that's not even aware of the issues they're not focused on. So we can make them aware. And then that information becomes part of movements. We can help all the movements of the world, the homeless movement that I'll play on my next program, and you can hear their voices. We can help them. There are solutions to every single problem, but there's no solution if we do not engage. So this is a way we can engage. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.